Welcome to Talks Around a Farm Table, a podcast about the diverse landscape of agriculture on Kodiak Island. This series is driven by Kodiak Soil Water Conservation District in collaboration with KMXT Radio. I am your host, Ian Zacher. Hello, farmers, producers, gardeners, ranchers, and ag enthusiasts. On today's episode, we have a special guest, Sarah Coburn. She is Alaska State Vet, and today we are going to talk all about milk in Alaska and try to get the best information out there for people. Good morning, Sarah. It's really good to have you on the show today. I'm going to have you introduce yourself, and can you talk about your position as a state vet?
Yeah, happy to. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for asking me to participate. So I'm Sarah Coburn. I'm the state veterinarian for Alaska. And our office, we oversee animal health in the state. So we respond to disease, morbidity and mortality events in livestock and other species. And as far as it pertains to today, we do have a couple of food safety programs that we work with. The produce safety program, as well as the grade A dairy program. So that's, in a nutshell, some of our responsibilities.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, I was looking online at the DEC webpage, and you guys got a lot going on there for just specifically for dairy. Can you give a bit of an overview about what the Alaska Dairy Program is about and like some of the things that, you know, dairy farmers have to go through in Alaska?
Yeah, so the primary program that we oversee is the Grade A dairy program, and that's really the most common milk that you're going to buy anywhere in the country is going to be Grade A milk, and that is milk that is regulated at a pretty high level. The milk's tested. There's quarterly inspections of the plant where milk's processed, quarterly equipment testing of the pasteurization equipment. There's for the farms that are producing the milk, there's an inspection every 6 months of that. The water is tested. Like I said, the milk is tested, you know, a few samples are tested each month for bacterial counts to ensure that pasteurization was done completely. So it's a very rigorous program. It's a state program. So each state in the country has their own dairy program, but then collectively we discuss every 2 years, there's the National Conference for Interstate Milk Shipments, and we discuss the pasteurized milk ordinance, which has been, last year was the 100th anniversary of that document. And so it's really, like I said, individual state programs, but then collectively as a country, there's a delegate from each state that discusses what that program should look like so that those high standards are matched across the country. So if there's milk going across state lines, we can have confidence in those products. So it's really important we participate. We only have one Grade A dairy currently, and they're doing a great job. But what that means is a lot of our milk's coming in from Washington and Oregon and other places. So that participation, we can have confidence in the products coming up here as well as for the facility that we inspect. The other part of the Grade A dairy program is the containers that milk is sold in. So we do have a manufacturer in Palmer that makes milk jugs that are up to the standard as well for Grade A. And yeah, so they're part, you know, we test subset of those jugs each month and they have a quarterly inspection as well. So that's the most kind of rigorous dairy program.
Oh, that's real interesting. I didn't know that there was a delegate from each state that would represent Alaska in sort of the overview of how milk gets distributed in Alaska. Who decides who the delegate is? How's that delegate represented? Like, is it elected or is it appointed, or is it someone who is like maybe not? It's not like a derived position, but it's more of just like someone's day to day position. I was just curious.
Yeah. So the delegate for our state, it's the state veterinarian or the assistant state veterinarian. So it's basically the dairy managers. And other states that have large dairy programs, it's usually their dairy program manager that would be the one attending, in addition to other staff. Usually other states, you know, California has many people that go. It's not one. because obviously they're representing a lot of dairies and a lot of producers, and their regulatory program's really big. So, yeah, so it's people that are intimately involved with the regulatory component of the program in their state that would be the ones going. And the National Conference for Interstate Milk Shippers is pretty interesting because it's the delegates from each state that are voting, but they only are about a third of the people participating. FDA is usually a, you know, the three-legged stool idea. FDA is National Regulatory Authority, and then industry as well. So industry also participates in all the conversations about any changes that might be made to that pasteurized milk ordinance. And that's really the big document that's out there. Most states, including Alaska, adopt that document as our dairy program regulations. A few states like California and Wisconsin, they have even higher standards than what's in that document. So they don't adopt it in the same way because they're huge dairy states. So, you know, for the bacteria counts, maybe they have even a lower acceptance than the national standard.
Yeah, I'm from California, Northern California, in Humboldt County, and in Arcata, there is absolutely nothing. They call them the bottoms, and it's just dairy cows for the eye can see. And it seems like from my from talking to them, they're inspected like monthly, depending on like what kind of milk they produce or what kind of just what kind of animal products they make, whether it be cheese or what's not. So you are technically Alaska's representative then. Did I get that correct?
Yeah. Yep. That is correct. So I've gone the last, since I started, and then I'll probably transition that to the assistant state vet. But yeah, I've been very involved with that program since I started with the state 8 or 9 years ago.
And so it would be fair to say then the FDA makes kind of like the umbrella regulations, and then the states adopt that. And then the states can either, they can't make it more generalized, they can make it more strict. Is that fair to say?
Yep, that's correct. So FDA, so after this national conference, NCIMS, National Conference for Interstate Milk Shippers, they meet. The state delegates all vote on changes that they might want to see. The pasteurized milk ordinance, the PMO, it is a huge document that has, like I said, been in existence for 100 years. So it's not the easiest thing to read, but the states would discuss the issues they think, you know, they might bring forth the resolution. Industry can propose a change to that. They can't vote on it, but they can propose it. The states all vote on changes they want to see, and then FDA reviews those and has some capacity to maybe override for other conflicting regulatory reasons or things like that. So it really is a state-driven program in partnership with FDA. It's not FDA driving what's happening with that document.
And at least part of my outreach here is to get people engaged in how food is produced. If they're not going to produce it, I want them to at least know how it's produced, as well as, you know, appreciating those who are producers, to support local. And so one of my questions that I would always ask is that as an individual who is unbeknownst to all the organizations that are out there, but I really want to participate in, you know, a perspective that I think like they want to be involved in how maybe milk is produced, or like, you know, how would someone at the ground level who's not a dairy farmer, who's not a producer, but really cares a lot about how food is organized and how food is you know, made, how would they go about getting their perspectives heard, and who would they talk to about that here for the state of Alaska?
Yeah, interesting question. So I guess I'll start by saying there's some other avenues for milk production and sale in the state. So I highlighted grade A. That is the most robust, most oversight. If you are a grade A producer, you can sell your milk anywhere. If you're on the interstate milk shippers list, you can ship your milk to Florida if you want. Within Alaska, there's some other options for milk production. So herd shares are one that have been in place for a long time, really, as a kind of as a legal decision as to what a herd share is by default. So basically, if you own a milk producing animal, you can drink the milk from that animal. That's not hard to understand. The herd share concept comes from, can more than one person own the animal? So if me and my neighbor own the goat together, well, then we can both have milk from that animal. So that decision, kind of through a legal memo, I guess, came about years ago to say, yes, multiple people can own an animal.
So the herd share is basically, I own the cow and I can... I can't sell the milk, but I can share it, right?
So if you and I both own a cow together, we are shared owners of that cow, then both of us can have the milk from that cow.
I see. Okay.
So there's not, you know, traditionally has not been a description of how many people can own the animal, but basically it's a contractual animal. You know, if the cow is at your house, I say, hey, or you say, you pay me this amount of money to actually take care of the cow, and then you get a gallon of milk every week. And I say, great, I will. My contract says I am paying for you to take care of this cow that we both own.
So
that's
like
really, I mean, it's kind of a, you know, a little bit of a nuance, but essentially, if I own part of the animal, I can have part of the milk products.
Yeah, that sounds almost like you're a cooperative of some sort. But maybe like there's a legal definition. You know, I think of like a cooperative is like when everyone gets together and they do the same thing. Consequently, some people are going to do more work than others, but ultimately they're all connected to this one thing. And so outside of that, I guess maybe I didn't make myself abundantly clear. As someone who wants to just, if I have concerns or if I have like how I can get involved with like maybe a milk changing policy, but I'm not necessarily like I don't have the clout of a producer or of a dairy farm or you know of anything of that sort. But I'm really passionate about milk and milk products in Alaska. I think that you know there could be some regulatory changes. Would I contact DEC? Would I contact the Alaska's representative who goes to these? To the meeting to look at that legislation?
Yeah, so there's probably a few different ways. I mean, talking to a producer about it, about what they do and why they, you know, for the avenue that they're producing their product, why they've chosen that. And, you know, if you just want to talk about the program, I'm always, you know, we're always available to chat with people. We don't make policy, you know, so that your representative certainly is one option. If it's a state policy, if it's, if somebody's really invested in the PMO, yeah, that would be us. I'd be happy to chat with you about that. And the Alaska Food Policy Council, that's a great organization as well. That's really involved with legislators and education and kind of knowing what's happening with food production and food systems in the state. So they're an excellent organization. If there was some topic related to food production, related to dairy that you wanted to be more involved in, your farmers markets associations, I mean, really anywhere in the network to be involved in that kind of food system structure and be involved in that conversation. Those are some organizations that are really active in that space.
Yeah, I get a lot of questions about who to talk to about, you know, who they talk to about food and milk and what's not. And we're fortunate enough to have Kelly here, and she's got the dairy farm, the goat, and so a lot of people that have questions, I send to her because she's very she has a very nuanced understanding of some of the regulations, and we hope to bring her on later on to talk about like her experience with milk production because she's kind of gone. She's gone from being certified to deciding that maybe that wasn't the best scenario for her, and packaging up a little bit differently. What are the things that that you had mentioned that we have one grade A dairy farm? Is that cow or is that just goat?
So That is cows. That's the Alaska Range Dairy up in Delta Junction. It's currently the only inspected, you know, full grade A dairy producer. And they do sell in glass. And yeah, I remember talking to Kelly. Kelly's great because she really, you're absolutely right. She really does. She understands regulatory frameworks. She understands local food production. She understands farming. So she's really a great, I feel like a great advocate because she can kind of understand why things are in place wherever she chooses to interface with that or where she chooses to produce, you know, milk or other products. She's doing it really from a very educated place of understanding the advantages and disadvantages and understanding why other people might do it a different way. So she's a great resource for people. And yeah, the containers are a challenge because the grade A, it really is from the resin that's used to make the jug, the sanitation protocols. I mean, it's really a comprehensive program. So glass is allowed, and even Alaska Range does sell some of their product in glass bottles. But again, they have to be at a certain standard and a certain design that can be cleaned and sanitized in a particular way. The caps can't be reused. So just to grab a glass, you know, go to the grocery store and grab a, you know, a ball canning jar, that's not going to be grade A because of the potential for chips, the cleanability, the reuse. Those caps are not made to be reused. So things like that, that at a large scale, if you can imagine, if Walmart's going to buy your product, they don't want milk in, you know, ball jars. that's not gonna hold muster. So it's really a level of scale, and and you can see where the change is if it's really selling something to your neighbor and it's, you know, half a gallon a day or a couple quarts a day from a goat that has too much milk for your family. That's a very different situation than selling, you know, thousands of pounds of milk a day. And then even those larger companies people might sell to, they have their own, beyond the state standards, they have their own audits, they have their own liability requirements that all goes into that as well.
Yeah, I think that's kind of an important concept. If you're like a big time milk producer, they're going to have like the company standards, then there's going to be the state standards, and there's going to be the federal standards, and they all sort of have to like mesh to make that market work, right? Because at the end of the day, you have to make the market work for you. And
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like
absolutely.
I might be a bit naive about this, but I think that you know, canning jars would sell just fine here on Kodiak, as opposed to maybe it won't work in California, right? And so like, but there has to be like a standard that goes across the entire United States, right? You can't have one standard for one state and not for the other. I think there's lots of rules about doing that.
Yep. And that's where, and there actually is a third category of sales in Alaska. So the herd share is really, it's between the people that are part of the herd share. It's really incumbent upon them to understand the sanitation and care of the animals and feel confident about that. The state's not involved at all. I don't know how many are out there. I don't know who's, we have nothing to do with that. So kind of an in-between category is sales, which have only been allowed for a couple of years. So that's kind of a new space, and we'll see how that shakes out over time. So there's really no inspection from our office. There's no required testing. There's compliance that's expected. You basically need to understand the regulations, and you sign off a thing saying, I'm registering, I'm notifying the state that we're selling this product, and yes, I understand the regulations. But there's no one with oversight, so that's kind of incumbent upon them to understand it and have what they need to do it well, and then incumbent upon the consumer to know, you know, feel confident in purchasing that product.
And I think that goes to, you know, being educated on the best use practices of you know, producing milk and, you know, taking care of dead animals and sanitation. There's a whole lot of reasons why there's a lot of rules about producing milk the way that it is nationally. And that you bring it to a point there that the state doesn't regulate that let me step back, that the new ability for people to sell milk unregulated, is that an expansion of the homemade foods bill that passed a couple years ago, or is that something entirely different?
So the milk regulations came first to allow sales of raw milk. So under grade A, you cannot sell raw milk for consumption. Raw milk can only leave the farm if it's going to a pasteurization plant. So that was, and like I said, the herd share was kind of its own thing, which didn't allow sales. So this is kind of a niche that was requested from consumers and producers. So that actually came first, and the homemade food rule came later. So I would say there's some similar intent as far as expanding access to products on a, you know, but the dairy was kind of one set of regulations. The homemade foods were a separate set, and then trying to figure out that interface between those two, or, you know, using dairy products and the homemade food products got a little bit sticky because they weren't written together as a comprehensive regulation. Does that make sense?
No, that makes perfect sense. Like they maybe like one spurred the other, but they kind of just like maybe coincidentally happened together. Doesn't necessarily mean one was for the other. Do you know how many people are out there with cattle that aren't necessary? There obviously there's only one registered grade A milk producing dairy farm in Delta Junction. I don't know much about cattle and how the state interact. Like if I got a cow, do I have to register it with the state? Like I do my beehive. You're shaking your head no. And I find that absolutely, I find that amazing that I have to, you know, I as a beekeeper have to register my hive. But someone with a big giant milk producing animal that has way more impact on human life doesn't have the same requirements as that. But do you, if they're not required to register their cows, is there like a, do you guys just keep tabs on who's got the milk shares and who's out there producing milk?
So the herd shares in particular, like I said, we have no hand in that. So if somebody, yeah, we have no oversight of that. We as a state don't have any requirement to register farms in general of any type. So if people are importing cattle, there's regulations we have in place. They have to have a permit to bring them into the state. Disease testing, a health certificate, a permit. So in that process, we would be interacting, you know, some interface with the producer. Once they're in the state, or if somebody bought a cow from a neighbor, or, you know, yeah, we have no regulations that they need to register or notify us in any way. So the raw milk sales, if somebody is selling, they do have to register with our office. Basically, like I said, they're signing off that, yes, I understand these regulations as written, and I will comply with them. And this is what I'm selling, and I'm selling through a store, because the stores also have to register with us if they're selling a raw milk product. And yeah, so they're basically saying, here's where I'm going to sell it, direct to consumer or through this market. And then the market would also register. But beyond that, how many animals they have, how much they're selling, none of that is regulated or inspected by us. So we would really only, if there was a complaint potentially, or a foodborne illness. I mean, if there's anything like that that happens, that kind of changes the dynamic and how directly we would be involved.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to maybe ascertain as to how much milk is actually produced in the state versus having to import that milk. Like, does the state have enough producers out there, regulated or unregulated, to meet the needs of Alaska? Because given the fact that, you know, we have, you know, almost 800,000 people in the state, it's, you know, I know my household goes through at least, you know, almost, I've got two sons and they go through so much milk. I bet you we're up to 4 gallon a week. And you know, to try to supply 800,000 people 4 gallons, you know, 4 to 5 gallons a week, that adds up. And given the fact that we've only got one certified dairy, is the state working for towards like getting more certified milk producers in Alaska? And I was just curious about how we as a state can get more FDA certified dairies, because I think that would be important to be like kind of like a self-contained state, given the shipping costs and the food costs it does to, like, you know, import everything. I don't ever really think that Alaska will be like a food export state. Like, we're going to send food, you know, we're going to export food into the lower 48. But I think that there's grand opportunity here in the state to expand on at least self-contained food systems. And I was just curious if you have any insight on that.
Yeah. So the short answer is, I have no idea how much milk is being produced in this state. But I would say current production, no, it's not anywhere near what the demand for the product is. That being said, you know, really Alaska Food Policy Council might have some statistics. Division of Agriculture has more statistics through the Alaska Grown Program and some other marketing initiatives. In the bigger picture of livestock production, and especially for milk producing animals, there's some real significant challenges. You know, what would it take to produce milk at a cost that we expect as the general public versus the cost of shipping it from the lower 48? That's a really hard threshold to overcome. And the milk that is coming in that's cheap, even with transportation, is because in other areas where you can do larger scale production, not just because it's larger scale, but because of the whole network that's there. The byproducts from, I mean, holy smokes, what cows can eat. Cows are phenomenal animals. And the bacteria in their rumen can take all sorts of foodstuffs and make it into the nutrients that they need. And they can do it. I mean, the nutrition has come such a long way in dairy production. You know, the nutritionists that really can formulate a total mixed ration, they can do that based on hulls from some nut production in California. They can do that from the cookie factory somewhere. They can do that from the orange pulp factory in Florida. So there is a network of feed that's provided by all sorts of other industries. There's a whole transportation network that's in place. There's a whole energy network, and the market is right there for those products. I mean, it's just a phenomenal connection. Nothing goes to waste. Nothing. Even from the nuts, some of the nuts produced, I want to say, is it the almond production? One of the nuts that's produced in California, even the bedding is made from the shells, you know, so it's a phenomenal and then they're using the methane gas to go back into energy production, even for vehicles. So this whole network that, man, what would it take to get to that level? With our short growing season, a lot of even animal feed is imported because we don't have an environment that can support the nutrition and the type of feed that's needed for a high production animal. So, you know, labor costs, feed costs, energy costs up here are so high that to do that efficiently at scale for 800,000 people would be really challenging. But on the other side of that, I mean, just food production in general, I would love it if every person in the state did something, whether it's a few chickens or even an herb garden in your kitchen. Is such a, it gives an appreciation for food production. It's a little bit of something fresh that maybe, you know, that you don't have to purchase. So there's kind of, there's all these different channels of food production, and each of them are so important. So that's a really long answer to a short question of, do we produce enough milk? But yeah, it's a big conversation that we could probably talk just about that for a long time.
I think you hit on a bunch of key elements that I had questions for that have already been answered. You know, in the grand scheme of things, they always say it's the economy, stupid, but that's not necessarily for Alaska. It's like, it's the infrastructure, you know. And so as a producer, because I don't do animal production. I do veg production. We still, even with vegetables, like as easy they are to get into the state, right, as seeds, like, but to building that infrastructure costs like 80 times more than it does down, even like even on Kodiak. Like we were kind of like this island out in the middle of the Alaskan Gulf here. Like things cost about 50 to 60% more than they do in Anchorage or in Soldotna or in some of these other areas where it's like, yeah, they've got roads that connect. Like I can't just go down to the Home Depot in Soldotna or in Anchorage. You know, I have to import everything if I need it because it's usually not available here. And believe it or not, like we do have cattle on Kodiak, but we only have, I think, as far as I know, there's only like two or three people on the island that actually do herd share for milk. And then we've got Kelly who does the goats, and I think she's doing cow milk. Don't hold me to that. I know that she's got a couple of cows. I know that, in fact, I know she's doing cow milk because she's been giving it away to people that need it. Like we have an island of, you know, 12,000 people altogether, the whole borough. And there's not enough production here to just even feed us. I think you hit a lot of points like that. It's, you know, it's like getting that infrastructure built and, making it, more marketable for people to make a living off of. Cause currently, apparently only one can make a living off of it.
Yeah, it's a challenge. And like I said, there's just so much just in the environment and the growth. I mean, there's a reason California is our, you know, breadbasket of the country, because the environmental conditions can support year round for different products. I mean, there's just ways, some natural efficiencies that can happen there that can't happen here. So that's where, you know, trying to come up with some realistic goals for the importance of food production and farming. I don't know if the goal is to be 100% self-sustaining. I don't know. But can we all do a little bit that helps with just appreciating and gratitude for what we can provide and sharing, you know, with our neighbors? I mean, last summer, this was like the best night of our summer. We had the one crop in our garden that did really well was carrots. Way more carrots than we could. I mean, there's three of us in my household, my husband and I and my 11-year-old daughter. So it's toward the end of the season that we really needed to do a final pick. And we got a big, you know, big boxes and totes and put them in our little wagon behind our four-wheeler. And we started going down the street, stopping at neighbors and saying, hey, do you want a basket of carrots? So much fun. One person came out, he gave us a basket of potatoes. Another neighbor, we chatted about vet medicine because she knows a young woman that's interested in the career. The next neighbors, I'd never even met them, but they were in the yard like, well, should we stop? We talked for an hour because we had carrots to share. They had two new foster children that sat in their yard playing in the playground and eating carrots while we met our new neighbors. Like, that's food production. That's culture and sharing and community that we can participate in. So, you know, to the highest degree today, tomorrow, in our community. That's food security, community stability, network of, you know, our community. So,
yeah.
Where does that fit in with large scale production too? It's all part of the system, kind of for different reasons.
Yeah, I always try to remind people that you know, the last 50 to 70 years or so that we have been really heavily engaged in the ag part. But less so in the culture part, and you got to get the culture back into agriculture. And that exchange, like you were saying, is very similar to, you know, how I meet my neighbors, how I meet my community. You know, I meet my community through food production. And anyone who knows me on the island just knows that food is an important part of building that community. If you don't mind, we've been kind of like digging into like policy and like how the state responds to people who do this. But there's just some questions that I get a lot just in the wording of what people use for milk production. You know, we've got pasteurized versus heat treated versus raw. I know that a lot of people won't buy milk because it's been heat treated and not pasteurized. And then there's people that won't do pasteurized or heat treated. They just want the raw stuff. And that kind of segues into, you know, what you read on the labels at the grocery store. You know, you've got homogenous milk, non-homogenous milk. And I was just curious if you could maybe walk through some of those procedures. Because I'm hoping that part of this will expel some of these misunderstandings that people have, and that they're able to make better informed decisions when they read these, when they hear it, or when they're talking to people. And that's that's not just like, you know, my uncle Sal's told me this, and you know, that's the way it's gonna be. So Yeah,
that's a fair question. So grade A milk, by definition in our country, means that it is pasteurized. Well, there's some nuance there too. But typically, if you go to the store and you buy Dairy Gold or Lucerne milk, it's going to say pasteurized grade A milk. And pasteurized means that it was heated to a certain temperature for a certain length of time, as dictated by the pasteurized milk ordinance. So for vat pasteurization, it's basically a jacketed, big stainless steel vat. It's heated up to 145 degrees for 30 minutes. The different types of packaging might have a higher temperature for a shorter period of time, but it's all based on the bacteria of the main concern for human illnesses. So those temperatures are all dictated by 100 years ago, it was brucellosis and tuberculosis. That's less of a concern now. But Campylobacter, Listeria, E. coli, Coxiella burnetii, I think is actually the high limit, is based on that bacteria, which causes a disease called Q fever in people. So pasteurized means that every particle of milk is heated to the correct temperature for the correct length of time. So that's kind of just a standard definition. It is a regulatory, and there's other products too. I mean, there's juices that are pasteurized and other things. It's that heat treatment for that product for the bacteria of concern. So raw milk, on the other hand, is just not pasteurized in its simplest definition. On a dairy farm, there's raw milk, and then it's pasteurized and bottled. In a raw milk dairy, it's raw, and there's no pasteurization step. So the heat treated is a little bit of a quirk of how the regulations were written. So previous to the Alaska regulations that allowed sale of raw milk, it had to be pasteurized to be sold. So like I said, pasteurization had the whole definition and how that's enforced and how it's tested to make sure it's done correctly. The regulations are written very specifically to say, if you are working under these regulations, you must do these things and have this label on your product, indicating it's a raw milk product and a higher risk because it's not pasteurized. So Kelly Foreman is the only one I know of that we've kind of talked to her about that heat treated. And that was trying to accommodate the fact that she was pasteurizing product in an unregulated way. So it's kind of a quirk because there's no allowance for that. When the regulation was written, the intent was raw milk sales. Well, do you put on the bottle that it's raw milk when your intent is to pasteurize and sell under these regulations and not under grade A? So we were trying to accommodate that in a way that didn't indicate that it was grade A pasteurized. It didn't indicate that it was raw milk. But because it's sold under raw milk regulations, it has to have certain things on it. So the heat treated is a little bit of a quirk of the system at this time. I'm not going to discourage somebody from essentially making a safer product at a small scale. And the grade A, you know, like we were talking about, has some challenges really at a small scale production. It can be done, and Kelly did it, but there's some challenges there. So the heat treated is a little bit of a quirk unique to Alaska. That was kind of a compromise to sell under raw milk regulations with a pasteurized product.
And that was Kelly.
Kind of the three categories there.
And that was Kelly coming to the table and trying to make that argument, right? Because I think, that Kelly does want to make the safest product as she can, but I also think, you know, as a small producer, that you know, getting grade A certified is an absolute onus endeavor for any small scale producer who's never going to be able to like make the profit that it's going to take to keep that certification. Because at the end of the day, a farmer needs to make a living. And right. So if they're too busy trying to keep with regulation and the red tape and everything, like they're not farming, they're doing admin. I think that was a great, I think I call it the Alaskan Great Compromise for milk, you know, she can still, you know, treat the milk, and do that, in the same space that, she can, you know, not have to deal with so much regulation. I think that was a great concept. One of the things that I get, you know, I grew up on goat milk, one of the things that, you know, that people I think have a misunderstanding is that, or at least there's a long line of tale that's, you know, pasteurization or heat treating like changes the taste of the milk. And I have not experienced that. I've had, you know, heat treated and pasteurized and unpasteurized milk of all the animals. I've had sheep, goat, and cow. And I've never really expressively tasted a difference between them. But I do experience a much different experience between homogenous and non-homogenous milk. And I think maybe that's what people... I could be wrong, but I do believe that's like what people think about when they think about raw milk. It's the cream, not necessarily the treatment. You know, when you get some raw milk, oftentimes you've got that nice thick cream on a layer on the top, and it's just, you know, it tastes and it goes down real smooth. Whereas, you know, when you get something that's, you know, what people are used to is the pasteurized milk in the grocery stores, and that's all homogenized. And I don't think people quite know the difference between homogenized and non-homogenized milk. Would you be able to walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah. There's so much that goes into the flavor of a product. But to your point, yeah, for me personally, I also grew up with goats and we had a home pasteurizer. And we would have people come over and say, oh, I don't like goat milk. I don't like goat milk. And they try our goat milk and they'd say, oh, well, this tastes better than anything I've had before. And I think it was the freshness, you know, and the way we kept our animals and some of, you know, there's a lot that goes into it. So on the homogenized versus non-homogenized, homogenized milk has been basically the fat globules in raw milk are different sizes. There's bigger ones and smaller ones. Homogenization, they mechanically, you know, essentially are pushing the milk through a small hole so that all those fat globules end up being the same size. And then it mixes the cream and the milk evenly throughout. So it doesn't separate even when it sits on a shelf for, you know, in the store for a week, it doesn't separate again because they're all evenly distributed. When they're not homogenized, it allows that cream to be on top. And that is kind of a regaining popularity. If you go to Oregon, there's all sorts of cream top pasteurized but non-homogenized products. And Alaska Range, all of their products are cream top. They don't homogenize the product. So it's pasteurized but not homogenized. If you buy Dairy Gold in the store, it's going to be homogenized and pasteurized. And I don't know, you know, I haven't really done a side-by-side taste comparison, but yeah, there's going to be a different mouth feel with that cream layer versus not. Some people don't like the cream layer, you know, on a product that they're going to have in their fridge for a week because it kind of, you know, it kind of sticks to the top of the container, you know. It's really a personal preference on that, but I totally agree that I think people mistake pasteurization is the thing that's making the change when a lot of time it might be freshness. It is the type of packaging, even the Tetra Pak, like the cardboard packaging versus plastic versus glass. Those all can impart a flavor. You know, when you're working with a local producer that might have different feed that those animals are eating over the course of the year. That can change the flavor. A big corporate entity like Dairy Gold, they've got mechanisms of removing the, you know, kind of the gases in the liquid that might have what might be an off flavor. Maybe it's a barny flavor, or maybe it's just, you know, a natural part of that animal's progression in their lactation cycle. But if you go to Walmart, people want a very consistent product that's always going to be the same. And that's one way to do that. And if you don't mind some variability, you know, generally for a small local producer, there's going to be more variability in flavor. And for people that really embrace that, it's like, yeah, you expect it. And that's part of what you like about it. Or it's more authentic in a way in their mind. But yeah, trying to separate out which thing is affecting the flavor that you like can be attributed to something that's not actually it. If you're not really trying, you know, doing your own little scientific experiment to figure out which thing's which.
Well, thank you for clearing that all up. I think hopefully that will help a lot of people. We are coming up at the 50-minute mark. I don't want to take any much more of your time. I really appreciate you coming in and talking with us about this, because at least for us on the island, we've got people who actually do produce milk, and it is, you know, it's small scale, and I think that it is imperative that people have the best information out there possible. So with that being, if someone wanted to get a hold of you, where would be the best place to get a hold of you?
We're available by email or phone, just direct to our office, the State Vet office. Our webpage has a lot of information on it as well. So there's a lot of information on the different dairy regulations and contact information as well.
Excellent, Sarah. I will let you get on with your day. I really appreciate you taking the time and coming on and talking about all this.
Sounds good. Yep, thank you so much.
Listen to all the episodes of Talks Around a Farm Table on KMXT.org and Spotify. This show is in collaboration between Kodiak Soil and Water Conservation District and KMXT Radio. You can find me, Ian Zacher, on Facebook at Kodiak Soil and Water Conservation District or on the web at www.kodiaksoilandwater.org. Music featured in this episode is Boil the Breakfast by The Chieftains, which is my son's favorite song.